Hello and welcome to the Pondering Primates podcast, the official podcast of the University of Edinburgh Atheist, Humanist and Secularist Society. My name is Daniel Sharp, I'm the president of that society and your usual host. The podcast is a veritable cornucopia. We have different guests on each episode to discuss a range of issues from religion and secularism to film, art and literature. If you want to contribute, then do get in touch. Our social media and contact details can be found on the Anchor page, but we're easily found by searching our name on Facebook, and our Twitter handle is at @UOEathHumSecSoc. So, with all that out of the way, are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Pondering Primates podcast. Daniel here as usual, and today I'm talking to Matthew McManus, who is a professor of politics and international relations at TEC de Monterey. He's the author of the books Making Human Dignity Central to International Human Rights Law and The Rise of Postmodern Conservatism, Neoliberalism, Postmodern Culture and Reactionary Politics. His upcoming books include an edited version of essays on postmodern conservatism and, alongside others, Myth and Mayhem, A Leftist Critique of Jordan Peterson. He's published in outlets such as Merriam West, Ario and Colette. And today, I think we're mostly focusing on Peterson and postmodern conservatism, since these are topics very much in vogue or on the news agenda, as it were. So hello, Matt, and welcome.
Very nice to be here. Thanks a lot, eh?
Is there anything that I missed in the introduction that you'd like to add?
No, not really. I mean, most of the books that you mentioned are coming out with Zero Books. I'm sure my editor would like me to do a plug for the line. If anyone's heard of Bed Burgess's book, Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left, or Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism, that's the publisher. And I also have another book that I'm working on right now called Liberalism and Liberal Rights, A Critical Legal Argument, which is a bit more of an academic-y kind of book that'll be coming out with Palgrave Macmillan. Either late this year or early next year. Not entirely sure.
Yeah, you're a tireless worker.
Like I was telling you, coffee and beer. That's the secret.
All right. So, well, segueing nicely into that, could you just very briefly kind of talk about the books that you've written and the books that you've got coming out soon and kind of your intellectual interests, the topics that you write about and are interested in?
Sure, I'll try to be quick because, I know this stuff can be a little bit dry. You know, nobody wants to hear me rant on about my life. But around 2017, I was wrapping up my PhD. That was the kind of focus that later became my book on international human rights law. It was on, integration, democratic rights, what international law can do to try to establish a more egalitarian world. But of course, just around the time I was wrapping up, it's when you had the Brexit election, you had Donald Trump getting elected. There were a host of other elections that subsequently took place, like the election of Matteo Salvini in Italy or Bolsonaro in Brazil, that really actually kind of threw a wrench in my ambitions for international law to provide this steering mechanism to create a more egalitarian world. So I really started to think a little bit about, well, why did this happen? What problems did it pose? And why were people attracted to these various forms of conservatism? And so what I started to do was just look back at the history of right-wing thought in a way that I hadn't for some time, kind of going back and cracking open my copy of Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France and some of the other seminal works in the conservative history. And what I started to notice is that a lot of the opinions that people typically associate with the political left, this idea of historical relativism, a focus on group identity, a critique of reason, actually have been anticipated by many canonical thinkers on the political right. And that was just kind of the germ of the idea. And what I did was take a lot of the insights that I gained by going through what Roger Scruton calls the great tradition of conservative thought, and marrying them to a lot of the literature on postmodernism that had come out of authors like David Harvey, Mark Fisher, who I already mentioned, and a few others. And that was really the genesis, both of my academic book on postmodern conservatism and the collection of essays that's coming out with Zero I guess in 2 weeks.
His subtitle is an Essays on Our Hugely Tremendous Times, which is a good subtitle. But yeah, on that, like, you're talking about how you obviously had certain academic interests, but then events in the real world, so to speak, kind of changed your direction, made you think about different things. So it just occurred to me while you were talking about that, how much does academia influence real world events, slash how much do real world events influence academia? You know, obviously academia has a reputation for being all ivory tower and irrelevant to the real world, but it seems, well, as I know as well, but as you obviously, you engage in it, it seems that it does actually have a lot to do with the real world and real developments, social and political. It's not just some sort of ethereal realm above all that.
Right. Well, back in 2017, you know, when I was wrapping up my PhD, my plan was to write this very dense book on legal theory that would be interesting to maybe, you know, 100 or 50 people. And a lot of academia is like that. There's not necessarily as many rewards you might think for being kind of publicly engaged or writing things that are for a general audience. A lot of it is about honing in on a very niche group of academics who will evaluate your work on its technical merits and provide you with citations and help you end up getting a tenure track job, ideally. But you know, I always have one foot out the door of academia. I did a lot of volunteer work through my PhD. You know, I also worked jobs like being a door-to-door salesman, a landscaper, different things that I need to support myself. And I was really appalled in a lot of ways at the origins of Trumpism and the xenophobia and misogyny that was associated with it, and the impact it was starting to have on different people in different social groups that I knew. It was really upsetting. So I decided once I graduated that I didn't want to just be an ivory tower kind of figure, even though I still do some of that. You know, my new book is an effort to kind of get back into it, the one on liberal rights. But I wanted to speak to the issues that were going on today because I felt it was my responsibility to try to influence and shift public opinion in a direction that I thought was more inclusive and more progressive. You know, now whether I've been successful or not, you know, I'll leave that up to you and to the readers. But that was at least what I was trying to do when I started reaching out a little bit more and producing some of these more popular or at least, you know, more publicly spirited pieces.
Well, on that, we should probably talk a bit about some of these concepts that you've brought to bear from academia into the, again, I'm using the real world with quotation marks around it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us something about postmodern conservatism then, because it's quite an unusual combination given that conservatives often rail against postmodern philosophy and postmodern movements. So what is postmodern conservatism? Why does it matter? How does it fit into the conservative tradition? And how can it be fought?
Sure. Okay, so there's a lot of different parts to that question, so I'll try to take them one at a time. One of the things that I highlight in both of my books is that there's a number of different ways you can approach the topic of postmodernity. So one of them is as a theoretical tradition, usually associated with a variety of French philosophers like Jacques Derrida or Michel Foucault, which approached the narratives, you know, the grand stories about how the world works, what we're supposed to do, with a great deal of skepticism, particularly skepticism relative to what had appeared before during the Romantic era and the Enlightenment and so on. The way that I approach postmodernism, though, is as a kind of cultural condition, which is how you see postmodernism approached by figures like Peter Lawler, who coined the term postmodern conservatism, David Harvey, Frederick Jameson, and what they talk about is not just how this is a theoretical position within, you know, abstract philosophy, but how skepticism towards meta-narratives, you know, these kind of big picture stories, is actually becoming ubiquitous across the body politic. So a lot of people now feel very skeptical about big stories, whether it's religious stories or stories about Marxism and so on.
that purport to tell you how the world operates, what you're supposed to do, what the meaning of life is, so on and so forth. And these different authors, myself included, try to look at what kind of politics, individual attitudes you'll see emerging given these cultural conditions. And what I talk about when I'm describing postmodern conservatism, then, is the kind of conservative reaction that emerges in a culture of postmodernity. And what I talk about in the book is how, for a lot of progressives, the idea that there are no more meta-narratives can seem like a very liberating kind of moment, right? So you think about a big meta-narrative that held a lot of currency for many people, you know, Christian moralism, for example. When Christian moralism or faith in Christian moralism declines, what you see is new political spaces and cultural spaces available to agitate for things like LGBTQ rights, to push for a reconception of how the family is supposed to operate, which can be beneficial for feminists, so on and so forth, right? But conservatives, of course, react to this very differently. They see the decline of these meta-narratives not as an opportunity to develop more emancipated ways of life, but as a threat to order, to cultural homogeneity, and ethnic homogeneity in some more extreme cases. And their reaction to that is, ironically enough, to adopt many of the same skeptical attitudes that you see progressive subjects in postmodernity adopting, but they deploy them much more strategically. So you'll see, for instance, you know, postmodern conservatives evoking skepticism towards liberal universalistic meta-narratives. You'll see them reject meta-narratives around scientific truth if that seems to contravene, you know, religious or national truth. You see them reject enlightenment narratives, for example, about how we all need to progress and adopt more liberal attitudes towards things. So similar skepticism there. But at the same time, they'll be very dogmatic about insisting that their particular nationalist, ethnic, or religious way of looking at the world is the correct one. And in fact, it's under threat by a lot of these developments, which is why we need to put our faith in political authorities, particularly strong men like Viktor Orban or Donald Trump, who will be able to re-entrench the stability across the board politics by reinforcing cultural homogeneity, religious homogeneity, and stabilizing a sense of collective identity that postmodern conservatives feel is under threat in the current era.
I think you mentioned, interestingly, in your book about postmodern conservatism that I think it's, well, it may be, it might be in the foreword, or maybe a quote from somebody else, but you say the attitude for postmodern conservatisms is no longer the West is best, just the West is us. You know, so you have, you kind of mentioned Ben Shapiro and how even in their own fairly unsophisticated way they try to, you know, make arguments about why Western society or civilization or whatever is best. So they try and argue for that. But postmodern conservatives just don't really care about that argument so much. They just care about the kind of identity factor.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, this is one of the things that I point out in the book. And I also point out how this is connected to a more general history in conservative thinking, right? People tend to believe that, you know, a fixation on identity is unique to progressivism right now. Actually, if you go back and you look at people like Edmund Burke, Joseph de Maistre, Michael Oakeshott, they were very concerned that one of the problems with meta-narratives, particularly liberal meta-narratives, or hyper-rationalist meta-narratives in the case of people like Burke, was that they undermined a shared sense of identity in a, amongst a particular group, you know, whether that's a national group, a religious group, an ethnic group, and so on and so forth. So they also approached these kind of meta-narratives with a lot of skepticism. You know, and their kind of insistence, putting it really, you know, superficially, was, you know, we don't need to buy into universalistic values and universalistic ways of thinking about things. This is the way we approach and view the world. These are the morals that we feel are appropriate in our society. They evolved organically, and we don't want anyone coming in and saying that we have to change them because we're doing something wrong. Yeah. Now, this attitude has shifted a little bit in postmodern conservatism, but a lot of it is still there. You know, this idea that, you know, who really cares whether, you know, we can provide a sustained argument for this kind of position What matters is that adopting this kind of outlook stabilizes our sense of who we are as a collective, and more infamously and more kind of worryingly, you know, who belongs in our community and who doesn't belong in our community, what ideas should be accepted and what shouldn't be accepted. And that's what we value a lot more than whether or not this is true according to some kind of rationalistic scheme that purports to have a universal epistemological outlook underpinning it.
Mm. That's quite interesting. That was one of the critiques, like from Edmund Burke and others, against Enlightenment universalism. Enlightenment wanted thinkers, you know, claim to be citizens of the world, or were willing to extend natural rights and so on and so forth to all of humanity. I think I can't remember who or who said this, but a common trope in anti-Enlightenment thought was, these Enlightenment philosophers, they'll care more about some far-flung corner of the world than, you know, the suffering at home or something like that. So it's quite, I'm just noting that it's quite interesting, these kind of mutations.
Oh, 100%, right? And, particularly this idea that you find expressed in the work of some Enlightened philosophers and philosophers like Immanuel Kant, right, that there's a universal humanity and we have obligations to people outside of our borders. Because shared identities, shared collective identities, I should say, are arbitrary, right? You know, there's nothing really all that morally significant about the fact that you were born in Scotland or I was born in Canada or somebody was born in Mexico. It's purely a happenstance.
Apart from the fact that Scotland is the best country in the world. Sorry, I just tried to interrupt you to make a joke. I was going to say, apart from the fact that Scotland is the best nation in the world, obviously. That's the only difference.
Well, you know, I really like Scotland, so no beef there intended. But, and this is something that liberals continue to point out today, and to some extent progressives as well, right? You know, why should we prioritize the needs of people living in our own polity just because we happen to be born into this community and share some values and interests with them when we could have just as easily been born somewhere else, and then we would have prioritized those values and more.
Mm-hmm.
Given this kind of arbitrariness, we should be thinking a lot more in global terms about our obligations in this universalistic sense, rather than give in to the temptation to be particular our approach to moral issues.
It's quite interesting. I think a lot of Enlightenment thinkers, or at least Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, that I've read a bit about, they tended to be, Adam Smith and others, for example, you know, they extolled patriotism as a virtue in the sense that it identified you with something beyond, you know, your immediate tribe or family. And so they didn't necessarily disavow, you know, local identity. They just, they wanted to extend it, you know, expanding circles of sympathy and all that sort of thing. That could be a separate podcast. We're kind of getting away from conservatism.
And I should say, actually, I agree with people like Adam Smith, right? Like, one of the things he talks about in the Theory of Moral Sentiments is this idea that, of course, we all have sentimental attachments to people who are close to us, and this stimulates us to act in a moral way that we might not have towards people who are considerably distant, right?
Mm.
But Smith always says, you know, that while this is appropriate and it's the beginning of proper morality, we need to gradually become more impartial reasoners, is the way I usually see it presented, and gradually extend, as you pointed out, our circle of sympathies to the extent that we're capable of doing so.
Mm.
And we have moral duties to do so.
Of course, this raises the question, I suppose, given that so much of modernity, such as it is, owes to Enlightenment thinkers. What is it about, then, modernity that means this postmodern conservative appeal, appeals? Why does it appeal? What are the problems inherent in liberal or left-wing thought at the moment? Because obviously, the left electorally is losing quite badly in many places at the moment. Why is that? Why are these old ideals kind of not appealing anymore to people? And what could be done about it?
Well, I think that one of the problems that people experience under post-modernity is a growing sense of enemy, and a sense of not exactly knowing who they are, what they stand for, and what their purpose in life is. And the thing is, collective identity can provide a lot of that for you. Mm. You know, you belong to Western civilization. Western civilization holds to Judeo-Christian values. Your point in life is to have a family and perpetuate this kind of civilization. And then it also provides you with an antagonist who's responsible for all the problems, right? You know, the support of immigrants, particularly Muslims, who are coming in and undermining this, our civilization, are the ones who are responsible for your sense of not knowing who you are. If we just get rid of them, then everything will be easy peasy again, right? And to some extent, you know, I think that this is a very nostalgic, reactionary narrative, but what I think the left needs to be attentive to is the fact that people want to believe in something and have some sense of who they are. And the kind of relentless critiques of essentialism that you've seen in left-wing theory echo the way that a lot of the local attachments that we had that provided answers on this have been dissolved. And while this might be an emancipatory development for some, like the groups I talked about before, it can be very anxiety-inducing for everyone else. So I think a modern left needs to try to find a way to provide people with a sense of identity and purpose without necessarily giving in to the reactionary narratives that you see associated with postmodern conservatism. And there's a few different ideas I have on that. One of the things that I point to is Bernie Sanders, for example, who you should know is surging in the United States right now, right? This idea that, well, you know, we're going to build better and stronger communities, and we're going to provide health care for all American citizens, and we're going to realize the progressive potential of our country. All that can be really appealing for people because it speaks to issues that they care about, and it relates them back to people around them in a way that I think some of the more abstract kinds of progressivism don't necessarily.
Yeah,
I mean, there's something really concrete about saying, you know, what we want is universal Medicare for all, because every one of you knows somebody probably who wasn't able to go to the doctor because they couldn't afford it. What we want is free access to university for all, because many of you probably know smart kids in your community who could have gone to college but weren't able to because they couldn't afford it. You know, all these things have a more immediate attachment to people. And I think the left has done a bad job of appealing to that for, at the very least, you know, 40 years.
Yeah, I think sort of strengthening something else you mentioned, regional and local kind of institutions, kind of binding people together into the political framework of the country and the international communities, is really important, because I think with, you know, well, with Brexit, for example, which is almost certainly going to happen now, I think, you know, one of the reasons that people don't like the EU, and I mean, I'm no cheerleader for the EU, I did vote Remain, but I'm very much aware of, like, its massive problems. You know, it's very distant. There's no, very little contact between the EU and people in the EU, the citizens of the countries. It just seems like a very distant, you know, bureaucratic elite, to use those words that, you know, were prevalent in the anti-EU campaign. So, yeah, I think one of the serious tasks is to kind of strengthen bonds between people at the local level and the national level and the international level, you know, chain, like a chain of attachment, if you like, or circles of sympathy. But right now, a lot of people just aren't involved emotionally or intellectually, even with these massive institutions.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And Jürgen Habermas actually had a book, I think it would have been Divided West, back in 2007, where he warned about the problems with the European Union as a very elite-driven project that kind of took a top-down approach to developing political legitimacy. Right? You know, we pass laws, and the people who gradually come to accept them, even if that's not necessarily what they want at any given moment. And the exact term he uses is the need for chains of democratic legitimation, which I think echoes what you're talking about. And this is one of the things that I kind of gesture to in the book, at the end of the book as well, right? That, you know, you need bottom-up kind of support for progressive projects. And that means hard work, right? You need to go in, you need to change hearts and minds. You need to start at the local level and then gradually build to the international level. You need to showcase at every given moment how it is that, you know, people's communities and the individuals they interact with it every day are going to benefit from the enactment of progressive policies. And if you don't do that kind of tough work and you just try to legislature way to the future, then what you're going to see is the kind of reactions, that political reactions that have been going on right now. So like you, you know, I support the European Union in theory. You know, I think that there's a lot of good that it does. And I lived in the EU now twice, and I like being able to move between countries. But it has very serious problems. And you know, it's certainly time for everyone to take a big look and a deep look at what those problems are and try to think of more concrete solutions that resonate with people on the ground.
Yeah, it's quite interesting as well that there was a sort of contingent of socialist and left-wing Brexiteers, or Lexiteers, as this ridiculous new coinage is as known, you know, who see the EU as essentially a sort of extremely capitalist organisation, and that's why we should leave. But that, well, that's just a sort of aside. Although I would say also that, yeah, there's a great deal of truth to that, but also workers' rights and so on are protected within the EU framework as well. And even if you do believe that, the fact is that the Brexit we're going to get is going to be a right wing Brexit driven by the right. So yeah, but it'll be interesting to see. The story's still developing, as they say in newsrooms. So yeah, we've talked a little bit about postmodern conservatism, and so I suppose we should talk a little bit about Jordan Peterson now. Could you kind of describe who he is for people who might not know, although I imagine most people have heard of him.
So Jordan Peterson, or JP, as my wife calls him sometimes, was a Canadian psychology professor at the University of Toronto, which you might know is the best university in the country, you know, by most international rankings. He was reasonably well known in academic circles, you know, related back to psychology, particularly the psychology of addiction, and kind of Jungian approach to mythology and politics. Politics in a very abstract sense of the word. But around 2016, he became famous both for a series of YouTube videos he did attacking political correctness, and then also for pushing against Canada's Bill C-16, which was going to include trans identity as a kind of prohibited ground of discrimination in the criminal code. Now, JP kind of made a bit of a fudgy argument at points that a lot of legal scholars disagreed with, that, well, what this is going to do is criminalize speech against trans people, and, you know, I should be allowed to say what I wish because freedom of speech is an essential liberal value. A number of people pointed out, like, well, this doesn't necessarily criminalize speech, and, you know, only applies in certain contexts, you know, so you're not allowed to discriminate as an employer against a trans individual. But regardless of all those kind of legal disputes that people can look into themselves, fairly technical, he kind of skyrocketed to fame on that, on the back of that. So by 2017, he was giving lectures around the world, and then he had his book 12 Rules for Life that came out, which was a bestseller. He did a series of interviews, usually with progressive commentators like Kathy Newman. I think she's on Channel 4, right?
Yeah. Channel 4.
Channel 4, Kathy Newman, yeah. I can never remember all of the British networks, but, you know, where she kind of was widely seen, I think, correctly as having won that debate and this kind of further increased his popularity. And so now he's a well-known figure. He claims to be kind of a classical liberal, but mostly speaks to people on the political right with his critiques of political correctness, his agitation for, you know, a more rugged individualism being placed back at the center of Western thought. And he's apparently working on another book right now that's going to be a sequel to 12 Rules for Life, though.
12 more rules for life.
Coming out. His main book, though, I should say, is actually Maps of Meaning, which was released relatively early in his academic career. I guess he would have been in his late 30s at that point. And it kind of lays out his philosophical and psychological account of how society operates, how order is maintained, why order falls apart, why people commit acts of violence and evil against one another. Actually, a reasonably interesting book, arguing for a Jungian, for I suppose I should say a restoration of a Jungian psychological perspective to try to place in the humanities, social sciences.
Would you place him alongside the postmodern conservatives? I don't know if you saw an article that I linked to in our prep notes for this by Peter Hitchens, where he doesn't really rate Jordan Peterson very much, because he seems to think that Peterson essentially appeals to a post-Christian West. And I'm wondering if there's a link there between Peter Hitchens as a kind of traditional Burkean conservative and a dislike of what might be postmodern conservatism from a more traditional Burkean conservatism. Am I just talking nonsense?
Actually, I don't situate him as a postmodern conservative, even though I've seen a number of people who, kind of drawing on a few of my articles, have suggested that maybe he is. And I can understand, right? You know, I write on postmodern conservatism, then I write on Jordan Peterson, and they may think that, wow, the two are, you know, one and the same. But I actually claim that he's very much a modernist in his kind of reaction to the climate of postmodernity. He wants a return to these big meta-narratives about truth and order. The problem is that, you know, modernism was beset by its own internal difficulties that was never really able to resolve. So I remain highly skeptical that a return to modernism is going to lead to any more positive results than it did in the first place. Mm. Particularly given that a lot of the figures he draws upon to try to argue for a restoration of, you know, the Judeo-Christian West, people like Friedrich Nietzsche or Martin Heidegger, as you might know, were by no means fans of Judeo-Christian values, yeah, or capitalism or liberalism for that matter. Mm. So there's a lot of tensions in his work, even more than in the work of the typical modernist, that I don't think he's really explored in all that much detail. And once you start to pull on the thread, reveal that there are very serious problems with the way that he approaches pretty much any element of his analysis.
Well, maybe that's why Peter Hitchens doesn't like him, if he's a modernist, because I don't think Peter Hitchens likes modernity very much at all. So, but yeah, coming back to, you know, your critique of Peterson with your book co-authored with others that's coming out soon. Why do you say that you want to take him seriously on his own terms rather than just dismiss him? So why should he be taken seriously and critiqued on his own terms? And what is wrong with his ideas in the briefest way you can put it? What are the central flaws in his arguments?
Sure. Well, I'll break that up into two parts. So the reason why I say we should take him seriously is I do think Peterson is a smart guy. You know, I would never deny that. Some of my co-authors do, but I've always had an interest in modernist arguments, and I think he does a good job of trying, at least, to argue for the reconstitution of that tradition. And even outside of my own, you know, kind of interest in his intellectual work, just in and of itself, it's very obvious that a lot of people do take his work seriously as a kind of intellectual defense of a certain kind of right-wing politics. And that means that we need to respond to that on the left by showing why it's wrong rather than just dismissing him or assuming that he's going to go away. Nobody's that lucky. So those are the two reasons why I decided to kind of focus on that. I guess the third one would be, Peterson kind of irritated me with a lot of his comments, like, well, the left won't debate me, and, you know, progressives don't actually have any arguments, you know, against my positions. And, you know, I kind of sat there thinking, well, hang on. I know a lot of people who've developed arguments against your positions. And, in fact, I know a couple of people, including very prominent academics, who promised to debate you. And none of that kind of got acknowledged in a lot of his rhetoric, very self-serving rhetoric, I should say, on this point. So I decided that, well, if he's not actually going to go out and try to debate any of these figures seriously, he eventually debated Zizek, but even that was a fairly friendly kind of conversation. Then what we should do, and by we I mean myself and my co-authors, is write up the arguments against him. So even if he's not willing to kind of go fisticuffs with somebody on YouTube, at least there's, you know, kind of reasonably interesting and reasonably accessible work out there that people who think there's something fishy about this can turn to that might be of interest. And so second part of that, I guess, is you mentioned what are wrong with his arguments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long do you want me to go on about that?
What are the is there one single thing that you could point out as the main flaw in his arguments, or maybe one or two kind of points, the main condensed points.
Sure, 100%. So we actually hopefully enough kind of bracket our arguments into two kind of categories, right? One is that Peterson seriously and badly misreads the history, both of left-wing thought and of left-wing activism. He doesn't really seem to have a very firm grip about what it is that people on the left want to achieve. You know, there's all kinds of examples that people have given this. So, for instance, my friend Ben Burgess, who's also a co-author, wrote a piece in Colette, you know, talking about how during the Zizek debate, Peterson basically acknowledged that he hadn't read Marx in decades. And the only thing he'd really read of Marx was the Communist Manifesto, which is a 40-page pamphlet. And yet he makes all these kind of nasty, inaccurate comments about what Marx believed and what Marxism is about, that anybody with even a reasonable background in the subject matter could tell you is just malarkey. Right? It's not really what Marx actually said. Now, that's not to say that, well, you can't criticize Marxism. I mean, I criticize Marxism, and I think Marxism should be criticized. But if you're going to do it, then try to at least hold yourself to some academic standards. And, you know, the same is true, for instance, Marianne Franco in our book talks about his approach to feminist literature. And if you read 12 Rules for Life, he kind of lumps so many different kinds of feminists together, you know, trans feminists, queer feminists, radical feminists, liberal feminists, without acknowledging the kind of diversity that you find in the feminist movement and actually speaking in a meaningful way to the kind of internal debates that are going on in feminist circles, let alone actually talking about how there are different kinds of feminist activism out there and there are different ambitions that different feminists have. And, you know, when you take this all together, it's pretty obvious that he doesn't really know a lot of what he's talking about when he's commenting on the left. This just seems to be a visceral reaction he has to certain kinds of social justice activists on university campuses, and then he draws on a few sporadic kind of theoretical sources to try to provide a philosophy, you know, postmodern neo-Marxism that he feels underpins all these different kinds of activism, and that's just not really accurate in any way, shape, or form.
So,
our first kind of objection, trying to rebut some of his criticisms of the left. The second line of arguments that we take is a little bit more friendly. It's a little bit more halting because we're kind of criticizing his own defense of neoliberal capitalism. In particular, I take issue with this idea that we live in a liberalism a meritocracy or a society that's defined by competence hierarchies. Now, have you ever read John Rawls?
Yeah, I've read little bits. I've studied him a little bit, yeah. But I wouldn't call myself an expert.
Some of your listeners might know that Rawls was the most famous liberal theorist of the 20th century. You can even argue he's the most famous political theorist of the 20th century for his book, A Theory of Justice. You know, laid out a very comprehensive, very moving in many ways, defense of liberalism. But one of the things he points out that I think is actually very intelligent and very savvy is, no, liberalism is not a meritocracy, and capitalism is not a meritocracy. You know, people get ahead for what he called morally arbitrary reasons, a lot of which Peterson puts a great deal of stock in, I think, in a very illiberal manner. And one of the examples that Rawls points out is, well, a lot of people put a great deal of weight on natural ability, particularly intelligence. You know, but if you think about it, you know, you're just born with a certain level of intelligence. You didn't do anything to deserve it. You didn't deserve to be, you know, have a lower intelligence. You didn't deserve to have a higher intelligence. So why should we put so much more weight on what is ultimately an arbitrarily distributed natural talent or lack of natural talents as it is? You know, and then he goes on to say, well, think about other reasons why people get ahead. You know, some people have significant social and familial advantages from a very early age in life. You know, people like Boris Johnson or David Cameron get to go to private schools, which almost guarantee that they're going to wind up in Oxbridge, no matter whether they're good students or bad students. You know, other people who might really have the aptitude are going to go to crappy schools that are underfunded, and their parents aren't going to care, and they're going to wind up in deficient situations. And Rawls kind of goes through all of these and says, you know, if you are a serious liberal and you're concerned with treating people as moral equals, free and moral equals, I should say, you have to recognize that all of this is unfair. And once you recognize that, that demonstrates why it is that we need to reform society to compensate people who, through no fault of their own, wind up at the bottom, and stop putting so much weight on this idea that the people who wind up at the top are there because they magically deserve it, you know, despite having a huge number of advantages given to them early on. And this is one of the things that I point out in my criticism of Jordan Peterson, right, that for somebody who defends the liberal tradition, you know, quite vindictively, I'd say, at some points, he doesn't really seem to understand the best elements of that tradition, which are this commitment to treating people as moral equals who deserve to live in a fair society, like almost any decent liberal from the 1950s onward would tell you should be the overall ambition of our societies.
Yeah. So what then, coming on to liberals and the left again, you say this book is also, you know, it's also intended to sort of strengthen the left. It's not just like a debunking of Jordan Peterson. So in what ways then do you kind of be constructive in the in this book as well as destructive?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we try to do is, again, we look at the two areas where we feel his arguments fall flat, you know, again, his treatment of left-wing theory and activism, and his own arguments for a kind of classical liberal capitalist meritocracy, neither of which I think are very sustainable, you know, once you actually sit down and analyze their inner reasoning. Then the reason why I think that this strengthens the left is, you know, purely from an intellectual standpoint, you know, it's helpful to have these kind of arguments on hand to rebut people who feel, you know, that we should live in a more inegalitarian kind of society, right? And these people are always going to come along, which is why it's important to have these kind of arguments in your arsenal, so you can be prepared to use them to try to win over hearts and minds when you're appealing to people's higher order capacities. The other reason why we wrote the book is in part to acknowledge that Peterson does have a point, that sometimes leftists can be too engaged in naming and shaming and just trying to dismiss people that they feel are arguing for immoral positions. And, you know, one of the things we state is that that's inappropriate. You know, if there is an argument to be had, then we have to make it. We can't just kind of try to sidestep it through polemic and through trying to shut down discussion. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I say, at least in my section, and not every one of the authors agrees with me, is that, you know, the left should have the courage of its own convictions and believe that the arguments for what it wants are strong enough that it can overcome, they can overcome opposition on their own merits, rather than needing to rely on some of the tactics that you occasionally see people ridicule the left for, including Peterson.
Yeah. So talking about some of the things that Peterson may get slightly correct, he obviously does appeal to something, and there's a lot of talk about how he appeals to sort of young white men who feel disconnected. Do you think there's anything in that view of what he appeals to? And if so, what is the best way to sort of counter the appeal of Petersonian-esque or Petersonian rhetoric on these matters?
Yeah, I mean, I can understand. I mean, I grew up in a small town in near Ottawa called Stittsville, and a lot of my friends are were conservative, and a lot of them really liked Jordan Peterson. So I kind of had a ground-level view of his appeal kind of saturating down, at least amongst, you know, some of my social circles from there. And I think the big reason why he appealed to a lot of these guys is that, kind of like I was saying about postmodern conservatism, it's really difficult to know who you are and what you stand for in a postmodern epoch. And this kind of sense that, you know, our identity is destabilized, we don't know what holds us together anymore, can be really intimidating and really frightening in a lot of ways. And the thing about Peterson is that he offers some good advice, I should say, on how to deal with these problems. But more negatively, he also offers a very simplified kind of boogeyman who's responsible for all the problems that can seem very compelling. You know, if you don't know who you are, you feel your civilization is being undermined, or you don't have a lot of confidence in what you and your group believe in, it's the fault of these postmodern neo-Marxists. And what I keep on insisting is that there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, there's a problem with not knowing who you are, with wanting, you know, a sense of guidance in life, with wanting a sense of purpose. And to the extent he offers some advice on that, that's practical and down to earth, you know, I'm all for that. What I have a serious problem with is him extending this to the political realm, by making fallacious comments about his political opponents that don't hold a lot of water, and then offering political solutions that I actually think will make the problem worse. Mm. You know, for instance, saying that the way to save liberalism is to go back to this idea of a competence hierarchy that real liberals, I would say, like Rawls, would say never existed in the first place, can never exist in a liberal society. And actually, if you genuinely are committed to liberal principles like the freedom of the individual and the moral equality of all, we need to be pushing towards a more fair society.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to inspire people to take more seriously as a kind of positive takeaway from this book, right? The idea that there is an alternative out there, and that's trying to create a more just, egalitarian society where everyone has the opportunity to lead a kind of life that's fulfilling, intellectually and creatively stimulating, and also involve forming meaningful relations with others without needing to be bound up in a lot of economic and social restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, well, again, it kind of harks back to your book on postmodern conservatism. Even though you say Peterson isn't in that tradition, he kind of still he's still a reaction to the conditions of postmodern culture. And I think, again, it might be a line from the foreword by Dylan de Jong, I believe, about how the left, the simple solution for the left is that we need to tell better stories to appeal to people. So, again, that could apply to Peterson as well. But I am aware we're running out of time, but I just wanted to quickly...
I should say, by the way, yep. Dylan has a really good YouTube channel called Plastic Pills. He's an incredibly smart guy, and if you get a chance, you should check it out. He's got some awesome videos on, you know, postmodern theory, postmodern culture, Trumpism, you name it.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to quickly discuss this whole notion that Peterson has of postmodern neo-Marxism, because I think I think Jonathan Church recently wrote for Ario magazine that Peterson's postmodern neo-Marxist label has something to it, and you very much disagree with that. So what exactly does Peterson mean by that phrase, and why is it silly?
I should say Jonathan and I are we cooperate and collaborate on a lot of different projects. I actually have a rebuttal piece coming out in Ario, outlining my reasons in a lot more detail. So anyone who's listening has that to look forward to if they're interested. But just summarizing very briefly, you know, on the one hand, I think that Jonathan is right. I mean, there's no left-wing movement out there now that doesn't owe some intellectual debt to Marx. In fact, there's probably no one in the social sciences, whether they realize it or not, who doesn't owe a debt to Marx, including people like Jordan Peterson, I should say. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's right to conflate all kinds of progressive politics and suggest that they're all oriented by this very bizarre theoretical concoction that's committed, you know, to undermining Western civilization and characterizing everything as about power dynamics that need to be overcome in order to establish a quality of outcome. And the point that I make is, even if you look at postmodern theorists and various kinds of social activism that are inspired by postmodern theory, there are extraordinary differences in opinion. And these aren't trivial, right? You know, if you want a very good example that is completely obfuscated in 12 Rules for Life, you have major debates in feminist circles right now about whether trans women are women, for example. Probably heard this term TERF before.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know,
a very better debate.
Feminists, people like Martha Nussbaum, for example, you know, to be a woman means that you are born with the biological sex of female, and you face certain forms of discrimination on that basis, and men who decide to identify as women will never understand that. And it is, in some senses, a very dangerous thing to try to include them in the circle of feminist agitation, because that risks undermining the concerns of, you know, quote, real women, right? Whereas for trans activists, of course, trans women are real women. And that's because the primary way we should understand the concept of womanhood is as a social category. And that means, you know, kind of biological element is far less important than the way people interact with you as someone who identifies as female and discriminates you against you on that basis, right? And this is no trivial or small political disagreement. And none of that really gets any real attention in the book. And that's just one example. I can multiply them over and over and over again. So when Peterson tries to lump all these things together under the label of, you know, postmodern neo-Marxism, he's not just doing an intellectual disservice to his readers by not actually presenting the stakes accurately. It's actually a dangerous thing because it means that we have a worse understanding of the politics that are going on in our world right now. And since I believe that intelligent and informed analysis is what we need more of in our world today, I really react strongly against that propensity.
Yeah, that's essentially obfuscation of what actually goes on the left.
And I mean, the same. I would say the same, for instance, I should point out, if people try to lump the political right into some single category or a single philosophical outlook. You know, when I talk about postmodern conservatism, I'm talking about a very particular kind of conservatism that emerged, in my opinion at least, at the very earliest in the 1970s, and that's really kind of reaching its ascendancy right now. But this by no means reflects the opinions of all conservatives or all right-leaning people out there. And I indicate in the book that there are very different streams of conservatism and right-wing thought out there that believe very different things. And, you know, you can just look at the Never Trump movement as a good example of that, right? And the reason why I think this is important is exactly what I was talking about, right? If you're a leftist and you want to combat the right, you shouldn't be trying to assimilate them all into one group, because that misses the fine details that you're going to need to engage with and confront. Yeah. And I think the same is true when it comes to Jordan Peterson, when he's making his kind of wacky comments about the left.
Yeah. No, yeah, I agree with that. I think, yeah, I think that's a weakness that everyone kind of feels pulled towards at times, you know, that it's very easy to kind of treat your enemies homogeneously and to just completely dismiss them rather than engaging on their terms, which I think I would criticise myself for that to some extent, because I really just, on Peterson, for example, I really just do not understand the appeal. So you've educated me somewhat on all that. But yeah, no, I think, yeah, there should be, everyone should make a sort of concerted effort to, you know, engage meaningfully and in good faith, as it were.
Yeah, and if you don't understand something, I mean, there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't know enough about this yet to comment on it effectively, which, to Peterson's credit, he will occasionally do. For instance, when people ask him questions about Islam, even though he said some very racy things about that, I should point out, when he's in a less intellectually rigorous mood, I suppose. You know, if you don't understand the differences between different kinds of left-wing arguments and activism, just say, I don't understand this, I don't like it. You know, all of it seems kind of frustrating and weird to me, but I need to spend more time with it, right? And not having the humility to do that also, I think, is pretty telling, and it should caution us against taking what he says politically all that seriously.
Well, to kind of round off with on that point about different strands of conservatism, you recently wrote sort of an obituary for Roger Scruton, who died quite recently. And he, I think you mentioned in the postmodern conservatism book, as somebody who's very hard to kind of fit into any kind of conservative category, but certainly he was not postmodern conservative. So I don't know if you want to mention a few words on that, you know, or to be topical, as it were.
Sure. Well, I should say, you know, as I pointed out in the obituary, I disagreed with Sir Roger about almost everything, you know. And not only did I disagree, but I found some of his comments, you know, really quite frustrating, you know, and unworthy of a man of his intelligence and respectability. You know, his comments about Islam, a lot of his earlier comments about gays. Sometimes, you know, when he tried to engage with his left-wing elements, he could give into this kind of shrill hyperbole. But what I admired about him was his intellectual curiosity and his actual willingness to engage with the left seriously. You know, not always successfully, in my opinion, but you know, he took more home runs than he did fouls, right? You read a book of his like you know, how to be a conservative. It opens with chapters about the truth in socialism, the truth in internationalism. And he does try to take seriously different arguments for these positions he disagrees with, which you see all too infrequently here. So I always admired that about him. And one of the other things that I admired about him and I learned from personally is, again, he was very aware of exactly what I was talking about before, not just the kind of discrepancies you see in left-wing thought, but the discrepancies you sometimes see in conservative thought, which is why I find him very difficult to pin down. Now, he'll sit there and he can write very eloquently about why Edmund Burke had extraordinarily relevant things to say to conservatives today, but then in the later part of the same book or a later essay, he'll talk about how Hegelianism and the philosophy of Jorge Hegel is actually more systematic and more interesting and more robust our defense of these principles. On other times, he'll look at a different kind of stream of thought and talk about the importance of liberalism and the American Revolution in particular, and that kind of fine-grained analysis and consistent willingness to change your mind if you feel you're being inspired by new ideas, I thought demonstrated a lot of integrity, which is why, you know, even though I disagreed with him about almost everything, I know I am going to miss him because I learned a lot from him, and I always found he was an exemplar of how to do conservative thinking correctly. And with a lot of integrity.
Well, in a kind of similar vein, though more polemically, I kind of feel similarly about Peter Hitchens, who's, you know, far more polemical and dismissive of a lot of left-wing stuff. But I find he's a very intelligent man. And so even though I disagree with him a lot on everything, sometimes I think to myself in taking a position, okay, so what would Peter Hitchens say to this? What would he hitch slap me with when I disagree with this? So I see that point. I think Roger Scruton is probably the prime example of that on the right.
Right wing discourse will be poorer without him, in my opinion. Particularly if, as seems to be the case now, Ben Shapiro and Dinesh D'Souza are rising up the ranks to become, you know, esteemed conservative intellectuals. It's kind of like, you know, if this is the best you have to throw at the left, then we're going to start missing Roger really, really, really soon. You know what I mean?
Yeah. All right, well, I think we've covered quite a lot of ground. Is there anything else? Well, I should say first, actually, that I'll put your Twitter account and so on in the show notes. So if anyone wants to look at your work on Ario or Quillet or Merriam-West or at your books or whatever, then there'll be links that you can go to. But is there anything else you would like to get off your chest? Anything else that you've not been able to say that you really want to say?
No, I just wanted to, well, first off, say thank you to the co-authors of the Myth and Mayhem book, you know, Marion Trejo, Ben Burgess, Conrad Hamilton, and Slavoj Žižek, who's writing our introduction. You know, this was really a group effort, so, you know, they get as much or more credit, certainly, than I do for its production. And I also just want to say thank you to you for letting me on the channel. I hope the listeners found it interesting. And, yeah, if they have any questions or they want to, you know, comment or criticize me for anything, they can always send me an email or look me up on Twitter or whatever.
Okay, so to finish off, we'll finish off with a light, quick question. When you're not writing books and reading conservative philosophy and critiquing it, what do you do for fun? What are your hobbies?
Well, my wife and I like to watch a lot of movies. You know, right now, actually, this is going to sound pretty nerdy, but we're watching Star Trek because I like The Next Generation, and, you know, that Picard TV series is coming up. You know, we also go out a lot. You know, we like to travel around Mexico City, hang out with our friends, experience some of the culture. I travel a fair bit, you know, for work and also for pleasure. And, you know, I also like to play video games every now and then, particularly Warhammer Total War. I'm a big fan of that series.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I've been watching a little bit of Star Trek Discovery at the moment. I've not actually watched a lot of Star Trek, though I really want to. So that's kind of getting me into it, and I like the look of this Picard series. When you're not you've got to take a break from reading Joseph de Maistre, and so you play Warhammer to release the anger maybe of they get the imbibe from De Maistre.
Oh, believe me, it's definitely a little bit of a release, right? You know, sit there and I'm like, all right, I'm going to conquer this country, and then you'll all know. You'll all feel my benevolence, right? Digital benevolence.
All right, well, I shall say thank you very much for coming on, and yeah, do check out Matt's work. It's always very interesting, and thank you very much, Matt, and goodbye.